Well, I'm glad that you're having a men's retreat as well. This kind of weekend's important. You know, we have rhythms in life, things moving along, ideally intentionally planned rhythms, and sometimes it's good just to step out of those rhythms, do something different, and step back and just kind of rethink the whole thing or rethink parts of it, right? Breaking the patterns every once in a while. And so we're doing that when we kind of meet like this, and we're also going to do that in tonight and tomorrow with this topic of friendship. You know, we have habits. Every one of you has a habit of thinking about friendship. It's built into your life in some way or another, and we have certain ways of living that are more or less helpful in cultivating true friendship, both for yourself and more or less intentional to help others cultivate true friendship. And so what I'm hoping to do with you is to just step back and for me and all of us to just think together, assess our lives. You know, is there a step that I could take? Is there a step that you can take to be more intentional, to lean into this joy-giving life of true friendship? So a question for you, though. What came to your mind, I'm curious if you can think back, when you heard that the theme of this retreat was going to be on friendship? Or just what comes to your mind when you think about the topic of friendship and connect it to your life personally? What's the first thought or feeling that comes to your mind? And anyone?
Sadness.
Sadness. Okay. And anyone's welcome to elaborate on your answer as well.
Individual people
that... Yeah. So you think of certain people. Yep.
Somebody that stand behind whether they're wrong or right.
Interesting. Yeah. Standing behind someone. Okay. What else?
Mm-hmm. Think of like the good lifelong friends that I made in college, but they all moved away, so I don't see them anymore.
Yeah. Yeah, you can think back to a rich season of friendship, and then it disappears for one reason or another. Moving away can be part of it. Mm-hmm. What else?
Mm-hmm. I think about who would be the first person I call at 12 at night.
Yeah, that's good. First person you call at 12 at night. They need help, or if you need help. That's good. Well, in my experience, friendship, you know, we have a lot of different thoughts and experiences about it. And overall, there's a sense in which sometimes we may not think of it as a very weighty topic, at first at least. We all know what friendship is, in a sense, right? We it's the kind of topic that might feel intuitive. You know, we have phrases or slogans or sayings about friendship. But we may not think that we would need to spend an evening and a day thinking more deeply about it, right? I mean, we have conferences and books on parenting and marriages and different relationships, but it's actually really rare to have a retreat topic like this on friendship. It's incredibly rare. And if we're honest, we may also say this. We know that friendship is relatively important or a nice option in different seasons of life, but maybe for you, you're thinking right now, honestly, I just don't have much time for it. I recently asked a group of men what came to their mind when they think about friendship, just sitting around a table with them, and one of the guys responded this way, that used to be nice, right? Once men enter their upper 20s and 30s, they often don't have close friendships anymore. They may have other men that they would refer to as friends, but often it's based on past experience, but it's not actually a functional friendship anymore. We're actually creating new experiences together and in deep communication. So we now sometimes joke about, you know, Jesus' newly appreciated miracle of having 12 close friends in his 30s, right? And many of you may know the trend, you know, of losing friends or diminishing friendships in 20s and 30s. It continues. 40s, 50s, 60s, and beyond. But friendship really is weightier than we often do think about. And so it's worth just resetting our lives, really, to think about how can we introduce friendship in a deeper way into our lives. So really my hope here is that we can recapture a bigger vision of friendship. And I say recapture because past generations, and past generations of Christians in particular, had a really high view of friendship. And the way that some people have talked about friendship through church history is surprising. because it's not how we often talk about it today. Here's just a couple examples. J.C. Ryle lived in the 1800s. He preached a sermon on friendship, and in particular, Jesus as the great friend. And he captured the significance of true friendship well when he said this. This world, I think this is written down for you in your note sheet. This world is full of sorrow because it's full of sin. It's a dark place. It's a lonely place. It is a disappointing place. The brightest sunbeam in it is a friend. Friendship halves our troubles and doubles our joys. I love that both for its realism and its hope. I mean, we know what it's like to live in the first half of that quote, right? The damage that sin does, life being sometimes a dark and a lonely and a disappointing place, that's realism. That's realistic. And yet there's also this great hope because God has made life in such a way that there's a bright sunbeam shining into our dark lives, and the brightest sunbeam, according to J.C. Ryle, is friendship. Friendship with one another and with Jesus, in his view. C.S. Lewis wrote about friendship in a book called The Four Loves, but he also wrote about friendship in his letters to his friends. Here's what he wrote to one of his friends. Friendship is the greatest of worldly goods. Certainly to me, it is the chief happiness of life. He even said to one friend, the counsel that he gives to people is, he says, find out where your friends are and then move there. Right? Now, we think of that with maybe a job, so it's not crazy to think of a priority and then relocating for work. And C.S. Lewis would say, you might want to think about doing that for friends. Factor that in, at least. If we move for work or family, why not friendship? For him, he had such a high view of friendship that it should be a factor. So these men and others esteemed friendship so highly because they read their Bibles carefully and they thought theologically. That's why they were able to make these kinds of statements. So my hope for this weekend is to just reintroduce us perhaps to the theme of friendship, give us a bigger vision from the Bible about what true friendship really is. And before we do that, I want to just get a sense of the context of that we're living in regarding friendship, our cultural context. So it could be somewhat discouraging, but it's important for us to think about this context in light of the reality in which we're living in our current cultural context. So tonight what we'll do is we'll just reflect for a few minutes on our current cultural moment or current cultural context in relation to friendship. You know, what's the current state of friendship in America and our own lives? And then after that, we'll reflect a bit on Genesis 1 through 3 to consider what it teaches us about our need for friendship. So let's consider our current situation first. What is the status of friendship in America, and especially among men? So we're thinking this weekend about true friendship, and in particular, true friendship among men. Well, there's plenty of evidence today that confirms that we are increasingly friendless. It may look on the surface like we're more connected than ever, right? Isn't that the promise of digital devices and social media? Isn't the promise of Facebook that we would be connected to more people more often? But many people have hundreds of Facebook friends and yet don't really have people in their life who know them deeply at all. Numerous studies show that friendship is declining. So just a couple examples, there's plenty of studies. So Cigna Health Insurance recently did a study of 20,000 people, and they found that 54%, so over half, 54% of people responded to this. They said they sometimes or always feel like nobody knows them well at all. Over half of 20,000 people, sampling of America, over half said they sometimes or always feel like nobody knows them well at all. 40% said that their relationships were not meaningful. So even those who would say, I might know people, say, yeah, my relationships aren't meaningful. So that's the culture. It's also us. The Harvard Business Review had an article titled Work and the Loneliness Epidemic. And in it, the former U.S. Surgeon General Vivek Murthy said that when he saw patients In his view, the most common illness was not cancer or heart disease, but loneliness, social isolation. In fact, there's a lot of other studies that show that the loneliness that people can experience or social isolation actually has an incredible impact on health. Cancer can accelerate more quickly if you are socially isolated because of just what it does to us deep down. I mean, the Lord made us embodied, right? So we shouldn't be surprised that our physical health can be connected to our emotional health or even social health, right? So these are all connected here, and there's a lot of studies that are beginning to uncover this. Social isolation is one of the hottest trends in sociology right now. So we should ask the question, why? Why is it that these studies aren't just showing that people are lonely or that here are the stats on social isolation, but why is there a decline? Because stats, if you look at the history of these studies over the past 30 or 40 years, there's a rapid change in people. People have less and less friends. So something like 35 years ago, the average American had maybe 3 close friends, and then just 15 years ago, it dropped to 2. That's a massive shift, right? And I think a fourth of people surveyed in this study said that they had no one to confide in, right? In other words, no close friends. And it's increasing, moved from a fourth to a third. So why is there such a decline? And in particular, why is there a decline among men? So let's just take those two questions. Why the decline in general? Why the decline among men in particular? Well, here's 3 reasons for the decline in general. There's probably others, but just for us to kind of get 3 general ones. First, because we live disintegrated social lives. So there's a lack of social integration. So think about how your life is structured. Think about the spheres of relationships that you have. So you probably have a set of work relationships, perhaps. You have a set of relationships in this room or in your church. You have a set of relationships maybe in your neighborhood or extended family, maybe something else. How many, I mean, just thinking about this, how many people overlap in those spheres? It's increasingly common to have no overlap or minimal overlap, and that's a shift. You know, at certain times you might work in the same town, and there might be a neighbor who you interact with in your work life, and then you have the same people in your neighborhood that you're in a church community with, and it's increasingly common to drive a bit farther, and you have certain relationships in your church family, but then you work in a different direction, and there is nobody in your work relationships at all or business that overlaps with your church community, and then you live somewhere else, and nobody in your neighborhood has any clue who the people are that you work with or your church with. And so that means you're hopping from sphere to sphere with a whole new set of relationships that only experience one part of your life. So this is increasingly common. And so we have this social disintegration that happened. And you know, this is why, by the way, that in college or high school or earlier life, it can be such a microwave of friendships. Because you go to class with the same people that you live on campus with and you might be involved in church with. And so you have these overlapping spheres and there's shared life and connection. Now, I don't know an easy solution to this problem. So there's a lot of things that we need to think through. But at least first, it means that we need to just recognize this is a real obstacle and think about taking intentional steps to lean into those spheres more because we recognize that it's challenging, and this may explain why some of us don't have strong relationships, or think through how can we overlap these a little bit more. Another reason for the decline in general is busyness, right? We're all very busy, and some of you have a busy work life, you have a busy family life, and you may feel content and full. You're wondering how you would even make time in this season of life for real, deep friendships. And I've noticed that even the perception of busyness can hinder friendships, right? Even if we're in a season of life where we don't feel particularly busy or we have a free evening, we have this culture where everybody's busy, right? And so we just assume, well, I'm not going to call this guy because he's probably busy. And we just perceive everyone's busy. And so you may not actually be busy, but everyone thinks you are. Right? And we have this kind of way of saying, you know, how are you doing these days? And busyness can even be this virtue, right? And so we give this perception of busyness off, and then we stop being together. I had a friend who told me that one time. I was talking about how we got to get together and stuff, and he said, I never reach out to you and I think about it because I figure you're so busy. And I was like, oh no, you know, and I've probably done something to contribute to that. And so there's probably evenings where we're both doing nothing, but we're both thinking, man, we're probably too busy, right? So busyness is real. The perception of busyness can even hinder that. That's why being at this retreat is even so helpful, because you can grow in your value of friendship together and talk together about this. You know that you're committed, everyone here, right? Committed to taking steps forward. That's why you're even here at something like this. And so you want to do that, because even if we have someone who may not be busy, there is a lowering of the value of friendship in our culture as well. And so we can think that you may personally have a high value of friendship. It may increase this weekend, but you'd be thinking, if I contact this person, I feel like it'd be such a sacrifice for them to give up time to spend with me because they may not value friendship. Well, at least in this room, we might kind of have an increased value together. And so we can pursue this together. A third reason, technology. Technology can certainly help friendships. It helps us stay in touch with distant friends. You can coordinate getting together. You can connect throughout the days when you're not together, but technology can very easily replace closer ways of connecting. So we can get too dependent on less personal ways of connecting, right? Rather than getting face-to-face, we use a phone call. Rather than doing a phone call, we text, right? Rather than text, you might drop an email. And then when we actually have something significant to talk about that actually really does require personal conversation in person or at least on the phone, maybe a confession or an apology or working through something, we aren't used to having those any kinds of significant conversations anymore in person. So we default to these less personal ways because it's easy. But then, you know, so much of communication is nonverbal, right? The tone, the eyebrow raise, the expressions of the face. And we miss all of that, which is why every one of us, right, probably has stories you can say of how things got really complicated really fast in an email exchange, right? Misunderstanding, misreading. We are the most connected, most disconnected generation. And it's continuing. So those are some of the reasons why friendships declined in our culture generally. But what about the decline of friendship among men in particular? So just want to hear from you for a few moments here. Why do you think there's been a decline in friendship among men in our culture? What do you think?
We were taught at a young age not to show our feelings.
Interesting. Yeah. So there's something going on with our perception of what it means to be a man where we were taught not to show our feelings. And then that can hinder deep connection, right? What else? Yeah. Yeah, so we pride ourselves on this individualism. How might that affect friendship?
Well, you're self-reliant, so you don't have to depend on other people as much.
Yeah. So you said self-reliant, don't depend on other people as much. Yep. What else?
Mm-hmm. Overconsumption of entertainment.
Overconsumption of entertainment. Yeah. I hadn't thought about that. That's true. Create a man, well, this is called a cave, no offense, but create a man cave in your house, right? And then you go bury yourself there, right? This is a man cave for people, though, right? You're together here. So, yeah.
We do. Entertainment is related to this, but we busy ourselves. We don't have time. I know that's funny. We don't have time to spend time with other people. I can do this faster. I can exercise without calling a friend half the time. I would have doubled my time and do that.
Right. That's right. We love efficiency, right? And relationships don't seem very efficient. Yeah, that's good. So there's a book called The Overflowing of Friendship, and it's written by a sociologist named Richard Godbeer. It's narrowly focused on male friendships in the founding era of America. So it's not a book that everyone would be interested in reading, but it contains a lot of letters and reflection on letters that men wrote to one another in that time, late 1700s, early 1800s in America. And it's striking that they were just filled with affection. They spoke very candidly about their care for one another, about how much they appreciated one another. And the author read these letters of men to one another, just typical ones, and he was just struck by that affectionate language. And so he's asking the question, as he did a deep dive into this, where did it go? This commonplace, affectionate language between men in America, typical of that era, where did it go? So here's just a really short sample. And these are just examples of what Richard Godbeer said is typical. So these are not outliers. This is just typical. James and Daniel. Is there a James and a Daniel in here? Daniel, James, are you guys friends? Okay, so you can be friends. You can be like this, James and Daniel. So here's just a guy named James, a guy named Daniel, friends in New England around 1800. And they had separated for a while, and so they had to just write back and forth, which is why we now have an insight into their friendship. And so Daniel told James in a letter just how much he appreciated the letters that he got from James. And he said that their correspondence had become, in his words, a settled portion of my happiness. He said, your letters to me are a settled portion of my happiness. Right? I don't know how we'd express it today, but it would be something really directly and clearly stated, something like, when I get your emails, your texts, your voicemails, it's one of the things that makes me most happy in life these days. Thank you for that, right? Another thing he wrote, I knew not how closely our feelings were interwoven. I had no idea how hard it would be to live apart. This is just two guys, friends. And he's telling him, I didn't realize how hard it would be to live further apart from you. I didn't realize how much our feelings were intertwined. Okay, so here's another guy, William, writing to a friend named Arthur. And William said, you don't know how necessary your presence is to my happiness. He's writing this letter at night, so he says, good night. Love me always and believe me to be affectionately and unalterably your friend. See the same thing in David and Jonathan in the Bible. We meet them in 1 Samuel 18, and it says, the soul of Jonathan was knit or bound to the soul of David, and he loved him as his own soul. You can trace their friendship over these chapters. They're in tears when they had to part at one point. So where did these kinds of affectionate friendships go? What happened? What changed in our own geographical area even over time? Well, here's two things that have changed that I think go a long way in explaining what happened. First, we've changed our vision of masculinity. Some of you were picking up on this already in your responses. It really would help to recognize that our vision of masculinity and relationships has shifted in our own nation over time, and we've just kind of breathed it in. So the way that we default think about what it means to be a man and what it means to have relationships, you know, sometimes we can think we've really thought it through, but we're a product of our culture in so many ways. Our vision of manhood is quite brutal in some respects, actually. And it strips men of more natural inclinations toward gentleness, tenderness, and affection and friendships, which is why you might even see some of that in children. And then what happens by the time they're 16? Stripped of it. In those earlier years in the 1700s and early 1800s, they didn't have a vision of manhood that was muscular and aggressive. Masculinity for them combined strength and tenderness. And so we now view things like affection and sympathy as maybe exclusively or really heavily feminine characteristics. And one reason why that was normal then and it's not now is because that was before Darwin. Before Darwin, masculine and femininity were distinct, but they weren't sharply separated. Men were able to express characteristics that to us sound more feminine without calling their masculinity into question. They could be tender and affectionate and caring. But then the idea of the survival of the fittest got traction, and over time it influenced our vision of masculinity. It became more about power and domination and strength, and characteristics like affection and tenderness were pushed all the way to the feminine side, so that if a man brings some of that into his life, it smells strongly feminine, doesn't seem like it can fit with a man's man in our vision of a man's man today. So that's one thing that's changed. Our vision of masculinity has changed. Second, we also have sexualized relationships. We've sexualized our vision of love in general. In Godbeard's book, he quotes from all these letters among typical men, and he said that when he reads them to his classes today, the students, their jaws drop. Because they can't believe it. Because today it seems impossible to hear those letters without some suspicion of romantic interest, right? Some suspicion that there might be something more going on than two masculine men enjoying a friendship. But there's nothing going on. Godbeer said, and Godbeer has even written on sexuality stuff, he would be very much, if you kind of wanted to wonder where he might incline, he might even lean toward wondering if that's there. And he said in his studies, he said, you can't read back our sexualized understanding into that culture. It really wasn't there. They probably were not thinking it. Those were just normal expressions of friendship. We can no longer hear expressions of love between men without thinking there's more going on. And we can do the same thing with Jonathan David, right? If you ever heard anyone refer to Jonathan David as perhaps having something sexual going on with them, or the wondering of that, there's a lot of studies that have happened the past couple decades that just are looking for that, and that people cannot imagine that it could be anything but that. And of course, what that tells us is more about our cultural moment than it does about their friendship, right? That we're reading that into it. So those are two factors that have hindered friendship among men today. And it leads men then to keep back expressions of affection or concern or care. It leads us to fear being too gentle or giving even caring affectionate physical touch. It leads them to refrain from expressing affection and affirmation and encouragement toward one another. It makes us just try to stay tough, keep conversation safely on the surface about things that we perceive as more masculine. So that's a glimpse of where friendship is today, a little bit of how we got here. So let's now turn to the Bible, and let's look at the first chapters, Genesis 1, 2, and 3, to see why we need friendship. So these will just be three quick glimpses from the first three chapters of the Bible. So if you have a Bible, you can open up. We'll just have a glimpse from each chapter. So first glimpse, Genesis 1, as we kind of lift up out of our cultural context a bit and plant ourselves at the very first pages of the Bible, here's what we see. Genesis 1 shows us that we need friendship because we're inescapably communal. So even if you just scan the first chapter, what you see is the Bible opening up with this beautiful picture of God creating the world. The first 3 days, he orders creation, right? He separates light from darkness. He separates the sky above from the surface below. He separates the sea from the land. So we have three realms. We have the sky, the sea, and the land. And then the next 3 days, God fills each of those three realms with communal life. So it's just teeming with communal life. And the refrain at every step of the way, after filling the sea with fish and the sky with birds and the land with animals, it says, it was good, it was good, it was good. And then as the climax of creation, he creates humanity. And we see in Genesis 1:26 this great statement. Then God said, let us make man in our image after our likeness. And then God created two human beings, Adam and Eve. And so he created humanity in community there, and then he commissioned them in verse 28 to be fruitful and multiply. So notice the communal emphases. God speaks of himself in the plural, let us make man in our image. Then he creates humanity in the plural. He created them, Adam and Eve, and then he commissions them for a communal task, to go be fruitful and multiply and fill the globe with communal human life, just like God's already filled the globe with communal other life. And so the whole tone of Genesis 1 is this flourishing world teeming with communal life. And when God created humanity, he said he was making them in his own image. Now, what does it mean to be made in God's image? Well, to be made in God's image is to reflect him, to reflect his glory. God's glory is the display of who he is, his perfection, his beauty. It's the shining forth of his multifaceted, beautiful character. And so humanity was made to reflect God, to reflect God's rule in the world. And so God emphasizes here that we're made in his image, not in the image of a solitary God who exists alone, but as a plurality. He refers to himself as us. We read on in the Bible that this us is a trinity, one God eternally existing in three persons, Father, Son, and Spirit. And humanity is made to reflect God. So here's what it means. that the triune God made us in his image. First, it means that God did not create us to meet a need, but to share his love. God is not a solitary being. He wasn't lonely. He's a plurality. He's one God, but he eternally exists as three persons, Father, Son, and Spirit. God's nature is relational. And so this is part of really what makes Christianity unique in the world. Some religions of the world view God as monopersonal. He was a personal being, but he didn't relate to anyone. He was just singular, isolated, lonely, not communal. Other religions view God as an impersonal being. God's more like the Star Wars Force. It's everything and in everything. But the Christian God is a unity in community. He's one God eternally existing in a community of love, in a communal fellowship of love. So this is not a lonely God. It's a relationally happy God, always existing in the fullness of community and joy. And this means that God didn't create us because he needed someone to love. He was already experiencing the fullness of relational love as a Trinity. He made us then not because he needed us, but because he wanted to bless us. He wanted to share his love, share his joy. Second, this also means that true joy for us as humans will not be found outside of community. We're made for a life of communal love, which means if you enjoy community, if you enjoy friendship, the deepest reason is because you are made like God. Here's how Tim Keller put it. The less you want friends, the less like God you are. So friendship didn't start with us. It came from God. We're made in the image of this triune God who exists in communal love. That's the deepest reason for friendship. That's why we are inescapably communal. So let's look at a glimpse in Genesis 2 now. So we turn the page to this second glimpse. We just looked at Genesis 1, which overviews the creation week, right? Day after day, we hear this refrain, it was good, it was good, it was good. And then we turn to Genesis 2, and there's a surprising statement. If you've spent time in Genesis 1 and 2, you're probably well aware. What's the statement that surprises us after hearing a refrain, it was good? It was not good, right? Okay, so something is not good here. Now, Genesis 1 1 through 2, 3 is an overview of the whole seven-day creation week. And then, I mean, that's complete, and at the very end it says it was very good, right? The end of chapter 1. And then Genesis 2, the rest of Genesis 2, rewinds us back into the sixth day when God created humanity. But in Genesis 1, we read kind of the snapshot version. He created Adam and Eve. Genesis 2 rewinds us back there to unfold the process of how that happened. And through that process, God started with Adam, and then he made Eve. And so here we have Adam alone, first created, and Genesis 2:18 surprises us. So Adam's there, Eve's not yet. Then the Lord God said, "It is not good that man should be alone." So why is it not good? What's not good? Well, it's not that sin is in the world. That won't happen until Genesis 3, right? Adam has not done a single thing wrong yet. There's no moral corruption here. This is paradise. Adam is in complete harmony with God and the world here. Everything is perfect in a sense at this point. So what's not good? Well, it's not good that the man should be alone. So Adam was perfect, but not yet complete. Or this picture of humanity, not yet complete. So this is the first problem, and this is so surprising to me, or striking. This is the first problem in the Bible. The first problem in the Bible was not sin. That's the deepest problem. And it'll come soon after this in Genesis 3. But the first one that we read about on the pages of Scripture is not the problem of sin, but the problem of solitude. And so this shows us our need for true community. You know, marriage is one way that God meets the need for true community. Right? God makes Adam a bride, Eve. And marriages, if you're married, your spouse should be your best friend, your closest friend. And you should be leaning into that and cultivating that as the closest of friendships. In the Song of Solomon, one says to another, "This is my beloved, this is my friend." But everybody needs companionship. It was not good that he was alone in general. It wasn't just that Adam needed a spouse. It was that Adam needed community. Tim Keller put it this way: God made Adam in such a way that he can't even enjoy paradise without friends. He has God and every noble pleasure, but he's alone, and so God says it's not good. Isn't that striking? He has God and every noble pleasure, and God says there's still something about this situation that can be summarized as not good. This is why Augustine, the great North African bishop from the early church, said this about friendship. Two things are essential in the world: life, not surprising, and friendship, surprising. Both must be prized highly, he said, and not undervalued. I mean, of course life is essential in this world. But isn't it striking that Augustine said two things are essential: life, and then the second thing he said is friendship. So I mainly just want to encourage you here. If you are often sad because you feel lonely or friendless, or your friendships are broken, or they're not where they want to be, if you feel sad often, it is not most fundamentally because something's wrong with you, but because something's right with you. You were made for true community, true friendship. If you long for true friendship, it's not because you are weak. It's because you're not a piece of concrete. You know, you're a human being. God made you in his image. You were made for friendship. Last glimpse briefly. Genesis 3. So this shows us that friendship is inescapably difficult, and this is because of sin. So before sin enters the world, everything is great. The world's teeming with communal life. Adam and Eve are together, commissioned to fill the world with communal life. And then the serpent enters the garden, and Satan did what the book of Proverbs warns us about. Proverbs says that there's one thing that breaks true friendship, and it's this person, this character called the whisperer. And the whisperer in Proverbs is someone who shares secrets, someone who gossips, someone who slanders. And the first whisperer on the pages of Scripture was Satan, coming into the garden, slandering God's character. And here's why this is so devastating to true community. Because the foundation of friendship is trust. You break trust, you break the relationship. You crack it. And that's what Satan did to Eve. Very first thing, Genesis 3:1. Did God actually say, "You shall not eat of any tree in the garden"? Notice two things about this. First, he cast doubt on God with a question, leading her to distrust God. And then second, he twisted what God actually said, right? God said they could eat from every tree in the garden. Generous. They just couldn't eat from one. And Satan makes it seem like God's holding out on them. So the main point I want us to see here is simply this, that he's casting doubt on God's character, on his honesty, on his heart. God told them then that they would die if they eat of that tree, that one tree. Satan says in verse 5, not true. You won't surely die. In fact, here's what God knows. Let me let you in on something. God knows when you eat of it, your eyes will be opened. You'll be like God, knowing good and evil. He's essentially just calling God a liar, and he says that God has secret and selfish motives, and that's why God's doing what he's doing to them. So when Adam and Eve ate the fruit, that certainly was an act of rebellion, but it was much deeper than that, wasn't it? They disobeyed God's commands because they distrusted his heart. It's underneath every single sin every human being has ever done. We disobey God because we distrust him. It's the root underneath every sin, and it severed their relationship with God and one another. I mean, the most prominent immediate effect of their fall into sin is what? What do they do immediately? They hide. Yep, they hide from one another and from the Lord. Right, they're sewing fig leaves together, making loincloths. Then they hide from the Lord when they hear him come. And they're covering themselves from one another because they can't trust each other. Once sin is in the picture, people aren't safe. You can't be safe with who you really are with other people anymore. And you can see that already right here. It causes us to isolate ourselves. Sin is inherently antisocial. Martin Luther said that sin curves us inward. We have this inward curve, right? Away from God, away from others, curved in on ourselves. This is why friendship is so hard. This is why marriage is so hard. So that's our glimpse from Genesis 3. We feel a deep distrust in God's goodness and in one another, and that leads us to hiding. We hide who we really are. We wear a mask. We project a better version of ourselves to the world around us, even those who know us best. And then even when we are accepted, isn't it really hard? If we've projected a false image of ourselves and then we get the acceptance we want, we know it's not based on reality, so we still don't actually feel known. And we're still hiding, right? And still then not safe. So this is the situation we find ourselves in. We're made in God's image for friendship. We're broken, so sin is working against our deepest inclinations for community. And we live in a culture that profoundly shapes our expectations and our experience of friendship. So we're all going to respond to this somewhat differently. There are factors that are true of all of us, but I'm sure that each one of us is processing this a little bit differently in this room. Maybe some of you are, maybe you're a man who has a family and a job, and you feel like you don't have time for friends, and you're wondering at this point, how am I going to actually create space in my life for this? How is that actually going to work? Maybe you are pretty well connected. Maybe you're kind of a man's man, and you're an extrovert. You have a lot of people around you a lot of the time, but you recognize that even though you sometimes seem tough, you recognize that you do need something deeper. Your relationships are not as deep as you'd like them to be, or maybe you thought they were even coming in this evening. Or maybe you're someone who does feel acutely lonely. Maybe you want friends, but you don't know how to get there. And you've tried and you've tried, and it just seems so hard for you. You feel stuck. Or maybe you think of yourself as someone who does have friends, but you realize that maybe you have settled for mediocre friendships. And we weren't made for mediocre friendships. We weren't made for mediocrity in anything. And so you keep in touch with your friends a bit, you get together sometimes, but things feel maybe a bit superficial. Or maybe you feel like Mandy Patinkin. Any of you friends of the Prince, or friends, fans of the Princess Bride? Are any friends? You know who Mandy Patinkin is? Inigo Montoya is the actor who plays that. He's a fascinating actor to listen to. Don't believe he's a believer, but he has a lot of just great reflections on life. Here's what he said in a recent interview. I think this reflects what many of us men are longing for today. He was asked this question: if you could edit your past, what would you change? What a great question for all of us to answer at some point. If you could edit your past, what would you change? Here is his response. I would have pursued more friendships instead of focusing so much on work and myself. I'm doing that now, but I'm running out of time. I'm doing that now. He's learned the lesson, but I'm running out of time. So that's just a lesson for me. You know, let's learn from people like him and say, how do I adjust my life now so I live without friendship regret in the future? How do I jump all in now? So for all of us, there's more. God has more for you. So let's open ourselves up to this tomorrow. Tomorrow we'll get practical, but tonight is just to help us reflect on this great privilege that we have of being made in God's image and being here in a group like this today and tomorrow. So looking forward to thinking more practically with you tomorrow as well.